I'd like to mention in dedication three men without whom I wouldn't be here, the sine quibus non, as we say at Rosh Bilaten. First, my father, who didn't get to finish high school, but got his taste of university education through the Lowell Institute in the 1930s. He was very grateful for it, and he'd be proud tonight of his Lowell lecturer. Second, the late, great Tom Winship, my first newspaper editor and the best. He was the embodiment of local journalism, a tremendously energetic citizen with his finger on the pulse of his town, and a global citizen as he grew older. And third, Charlie Nesson of the Berkman Center at the Harvard Law School, the sponsor of my travels in local global radio in the last several months, a fount of ideas and enthusiasm, an enabler in the mystery realm of cultures and other good things that are trying to happen. So thank you, Dad, thank you, Tom, thank you, Charlie, for, as Yogi Berra said, making this occasion necessary. So what is this culture trying to happen? We had to go to press with a title, any old title, before I was entirely sure of the answer, but I did have a glimmer. We had embarked on a series of local global radio talk shows, parachute radio, dropping into Jamaica and then Ghana and then Singapore, call-in talk shows for local broadcast and the global internet, landing like the proverbial Martian and saying, take me to your interesting talkers, which is becoming my habit now, a different way of visiting the world. As the revolutionaries used to say, first seize the radio station, and then start talking, start asking questions. Paul Theroux, the writer, has a famous way now of kayaking around a faraway place to get the feel of it. Johnny Apple, my old pal from the New York Times, is making a new career eating his way through the wilds of Australia or Wales and reporting on the country and its culture by its food. Once upon a time, as a political reporter, I would have been trying to interview the prime ministers of these various places, but the mode I've fallen into is talk radio, strange host, strange territory, engaged in local chat, but listening for global resonances. The premise, or the glimmer, was that there is an unmet appetite out there and in here for another conversation. I observe now that the appetite is verging on the ravenous. Not for more CNN, not for more New York Times, not even for more BBC, but for an interactive, live, non-commercial, anti-imperial, democratic exchange across the color line, across the political line, across the poverty line in the world, a conversation that might be about anything and is open explicitly to cultural issues and identity questions. This is the culture that's trying to happen. Shall we talk about it? I could also define it by saying, when you suddenly haven't got your real radio show, try a fantasy radio show, and then bring the fantasy to life. Part of the motive in the mission, for me, was a palpable polarization of the world since 9/11. Official America, it strikes me, including a lot of its journalism, is in the grip of a neo-imperial impulse that is both cultural and commercial. We want all the oil, and we want all the airtime. We feel omnipotent, at the same time we feel terribly wounded. We point fingers at axes of evil, and we suspect billions and billions of people of terrorism. We seem to lust after a clash of civilizations. I feel this fantasy lurking inside the Bush administration that we can somehow recapitulate several centuries of the Portuguese, Dutch, French, Spanish, and British empires, turning the world that doesn't look like us into those colonial others, what the Brits used to call WOGs, wily Oriental gentlemen, although there are more unpleasant names for them. But do we suppose that we really can lord it over so many people that we do not know? Are we mindful that by the middle of this 21st century, the European and North American populations, all told, will account for roughly 10% of the living species? Do we care to get acquainted with the other 90? I felt, in any event, an urge to eavesdrop and to share what I heard. And of course, the internet, as an infinite extension of radio, is the means of making any conversation global. So this was the mission, to slip in under the official radar and find what people wanted to talk about and how they wanted to talk about it. I wasn't looking for anti-Americanism, and it's not what I found in any event, but the perspectives on us are startling. In Jamaica last December, by chance, I get into a deep conversation with an eminent local painter who went off on the subject of John Walker, the young American who had gone native in Afghanistan and had just been brought back for trial. He said, "A great American hero, John Walker. And your people want to hang him at ground zero." He said, "John Walker wanted to understand the Arab mind by learning their languages and penetrating their religion. They should make him U.S. ambassador to the whole Arab world. He's an old-fashioned American adventurer, and they want to kill him." This crystallized for me the notion that the world is not against us exactly, but it does not see things our way either. I'm remembering an English Ghanaian I met, a white man named John Collins, who made it into a Ghanaian guitar band as a teenager, long ago, a bit of a freak, sort of white boy playing African music. He went native, became a significant player and writer in the African music scene, and he said to me in the nicest British manner, "You know, the Brits in the imperial days sent out ethnographers and artists and reporters and novelists to send back stories on the lands that they came to rule. The Americans want to rule the world without knowing it. But the world knows us too well, and it's come to know itself too well in these post-colonial years to be otherized all over again, to be reduced to much less than full citizenship." When I got to Singapore 3 weeks ago and walked into News Radio 938, where I would be working, the first thing the program director said after hello was, "Do you understand about the OB markers?" "The OB what?" I said. I was thinking Obi-Wan Kenobi or something. She said, "No, the out-of-bounds markers," meaning the things we don't talk about. "And just where are they?" I said. She said she couldn't say because nobody knew precisely, but we would all find out afterward if I hit one or shot beyond them. But the short form was, you can't have the opposition on the air and you can't talk politics. The rest was for me to figure out. But very quickly, I found a hero in Singapore who became my guide to the OB markers. Jack Neal made his name as a slapstick comedian, a clown on Chinese language television in Singapore. But he's graduated to become an independent movie maker who can make you cry as well as laugh. He's a sort of Charlie Chaplin of Singapore. He's got a huge hit right now in the local market. It's called I Not Stupid. And it has made movies the place where Singaporeans do the impossible, which is talk back to the nanny state and make fun of themselves. The movie is about three miserable, underachieving boys in a pressure cooker of a school. Their parents scream that they're hectoring and spoiling and controlling their kids for their own good because they want them to grow and be happy. And the kids whimper in response that what they'd really like is freedom. Nobody denies, and especially Jack Neo doesn't deny, that I Not Stupid is all about the superbly efficient, enveloping, stifling Singaporean state and the citizens who are never let out of their political adolescence. On our program, Jack Neo said, "We all telling these political jokes, but not openly. So I say, why not? I think it's my duty to tell the authorities, the relevant people, to let people know the problems we face." He said, and many callers to our program said it too, about this movie, "This is the voice from the Singaporean's heart." And wonder of wonders, the censors passed the movie, uncut, and now the Singaporean government, in rather a typical spasm of self-improvement, is urging the people to see it. I thought, this is another little piece of the culture trying to happen. And if it can happen in Singapore, you'd think it can happen anywhere. We did 2 weeks of radio each in three cities, Kingston, Accra, and Singapore, which is to say the Caribbean, West Africa, and Southeast Asia, or you could say developing, underdeveloped, and overdeveloped nations, each of them 40 years, give or take, out of British colonialism, all community English-speaking. Jamaica, one of the most deeply indebted countries in the world, Ghana officially HIPC, as they say, H-I-P-C, highly indebted poor country, on the World Bank sick list, poorer today than when Kwame Nkrumah celebrated independence in 1957. Singapore, debt-free, with per capita income approaching $30,000 a year, more BMWs and more Armani outlets than you see in New York. Jamaica and Singapore at the poles make a sort of pair, both island nations, still curiously, or at least superficially, British. One bursts with music, one bursts with money. Each covertly admires and maybe envies the other. Singaporeans worry that with all that stifling order, they're facing a creativity crisis in entrepreneurship as well as the arts. And Jamaicans, with all that macho vitality, worry that the Kingston murder rate has dimensions a lot like a civil war. Forgive me if I digress a little bit. I'm thinking of this less as a lecture and more as a radio program with myself. I'm still unpacking my head of a lot of the things that people said to me in Singapore, and I'm still reeling from the place in general. I was there 3 days ago. The air-conditioned nation, this perfumed cage, the mightiest little city-state since Imperial Rome, or perhaps since Venice in the 15th century, and a curiously unhappy place, it seemed to me. I'm thinking, for example, an eminent architect who looks around at the Disneyland malls and the very un-Asian, untropical skyscrapers of Singapore with a great deal of dismay. He said to me, kitsch is very big in Asia. It works as a narcotic. It dulls the senses in a pleasurable way. It's an anesthetic in that it prevents you from knowing what's going on, and so it has political value. In another verse, he said, people mix up these words modernity, modernization, and modernism. They're three different things. We've had modernization, but not modernity. Being modern, he said, is about autonomy. We don't have it. And then he had this killer line. We were driving around the shining streets of Singapore, and he said to me, we know now from a lot of history that the human spirit is invincible in the face of adversity. He said, but I've decided that the human spirit is defenseless in the grip of wealth. Here's this very hot young poet in Singapore, a medical student with Malayan roots. His name is Alfian Sa'at. He's writing about the lords of the endless construction, the creative destruction that is day-to-day Singapore. He writes about the pawns of the upgrading empire who plan Lego cineplexes, Tupperware playgrounds, suicidal balconies, carnal parks of cardboard and condoms, and before we know it, we are a colony again. Here's a young playwright, Chong Tse-Chien. He said on our radio program, it's difficult to define the Singaporean metaphor, the Singaporean voice, and even if we find this voice, we wouldn't want to recognize it unless someone from the US or the West would give us a prize for it. In a sense, we're spoiled here because we have everything in the world we could possibly have, but nothing which we can claim that truly belongs to us. He said, I think that, so far, has been the struggle and the metaphor. And mind you, these are all committed Singaporeans, patriots at heart, in the spirit enunciated by one of their great heroes, the playwright Kuo Pao Kun, who said, some people say, can't write, la, you know, censorship too strict. I say, come on, man, you're only worth 2 cents. Because you want to write, not because people allow you to write. As they say, freedom is never given, freedom can only be gotten. And in that spirit, these Singaporeans keep writing. In this culture that I imagine trying to happen, the question is, what is it that people want to talk about? Here's my answer. The great hunger in the world among the lucky people who have enough to eat is for an authentic voice in this global culture. Singapore may be an acute instance of people yearning to be heard and treated as grown-ups. The founding father and now senior minister of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, brags with that great Singaporean touch for commerce that Singapore is a brand in the world, and it is. But this quest for voice and identity runs a lot deeper than branding. The last thing I want to do is to average out the experience of these places, but of course, I do keep asking myself, of all those voices I've heard, which are the ones that anyone among you would remember forever? And are the connections among them? There may be no theme here at all, except the universal love of Gad, and yet there are threads. One of them is my impression that some of the most important subjects in the world are things we don't yet know how to talk about. Slavery seems to me the outstanding example. If there's one line from the last 6 months that's going to stick with me forever, it's the observation by a great young Ghanaian poet, Kwadwo Opoku Adjumong, who teaches at the University of Cape Coast, hard by that Cape Coast castle where captured Africans were warehoused for the Middle Passage to the New World. Slavery, he writes, is the living wound under the patchwork of scars. A lot of time has passed, yet whole nations cry, sometimes softly, sometimes harshly, oftentimes without knowing why. It's not just the great crime that has never been redressed, it's a story that's not yet half told. We have many slave narratives, as Opoku Adjumong points out, but we have very few narratives from the families who were left in Africa, who found themselves suddenly and forever fatherless, or brotherless, or motherless, or daughterless. In Ghana, I interviewed, as it happened, a Harvard professor of history, Emmanuel Achampong, who was back home in Ghana on sabbatical, who told me a remarkable thing. He got his BA from the University of Ghana in history, but he was introduced to the history of slavery at the University of Virginia. He said, that was where my learning process began. On our program, he went on, he said, West Africans are different from Americans in that way, in that they choose not to talk about unfree ancestry. Oddly enough, it was Jamaican dancers invited to an arts festival at Cape Coast in the mid-90s who went on strike against this silence. They would not dance, they said, on the bones of their ancestors in that castle, and they didn't. But they did break a certain collective amnesia in Ghana, and they started a conversation that is still building today. And I say it was a privilege for me to have a small piece of it on our air. The idea of slavery as a living wound extended a point that had struck me in Jamaica, spoken by the spiritual leader inside the prisons of Kingston. A remarkable man named Desmond Green is the rallying point inside Jamaica's teeming prisons, rallying point of a broad movement toward individual rehabilitation and social recovery. But he had said to me, I didn't know quite what to make of it at the time, but he said, Jamaica has yet to forgive itself for being born in slavery. A culture of violence comes naturally, he said, in a nation that thinks it is bad. People want to talk this out, however many decades it takes. It's humbling for us, and for me, and all of us, and sad to remember that it was the white folk, led by the Bush administration, who bailed out of the UN's Durban Conference on Racism and the Legacies of Slavery last summer, so soon, as it turned out, before 9/11, as if we had nothing to contribute or nothing to learn. I suspect that if we had another chance after 9/11, we would want to get in on that conversation and we'd find a way to go to Durban. But let's just open the discussion again, not to get stuck on reparations, but to dig into the inescapable moral and emotional burden of that past. So many other talkable subjects are barely tapped. The easiest way I find to get a revealing and wide-ranging conversation going anywhere is to play some version of the BBC classic program Desert Island Discs and ask people, anybody, to name and play and argue their favorite music, say their favorite Ghanaian recordings or their favorite reggae bands. These conversations invariably buzz with overtones beyond music, overtones of some other unearthly, invisible, impalpable, powerful mystery, love, God, truth, that sort of thing, and those programs always work. People also want to talk about globalization, the economics, yes, the marketplace without borders, but also the global human genome, the global environment, the imbalance of voices in the global culture. People long for countervailing voices in the one hyperpower world. Not that they missed the Russians especially, but people old enough to remember Nkrumah and Nasser and Nehru and De Gaulle missed those symbols of alternative visions of the developing future. I mean, there's Nelson Mandela, but he's not enough, which is just to say, in summing up, first, in this summing up of impressions, that there's just so much to talk about out there. Second, general point, cultural identity feels to me like the most precious thing in the world, and the Africans I met are super abundantly blessed. African culture is under siege, as always. Guinness beer billboards are everywhere in Ghana. So is international trash music. Maybe the strangest thing to hear in the land of the drum, and in Ghana, the proudest rhythm culture in all of Africa, is the sound of the computerized drum machine, which is inescapable on the commercial airwaves. You just have to pray alongside African musicians that this scourge will pass, and I expect it will, because not just the African musical tradition, but the history of adaptation and reinvention in that tradition runs so strong and so deep. We've had many conversations in this series about voices in the global culture, but none was more confident than the comment of the Ghanaian polymath Amos Anyamedu. I said, what is Africa's comparative advantage in the cultural marketplace, Amos? And he said, Africa has all the content. Simple as that. He said, you talk about music or design, we are significantly endowed. Even though, as he said, many of those fashionable Kinte stoles that are sold in New York these days are manufactured in Korea. He said, the system that generates the content will always be with us. And then he added an afterthought, the challenge is how to make money on it. The third general point, the neo-imperial pretensions of the US government, the carpet bombing of mostly innocents in Afghanistan, the Freudian slips about a crusade against Islam, the blank check for Israel in a one-sided war with the Palestinians, these and many other symptoms of xenophobic superpowerdom run amok, look from the other end of the scope, not just obnoxious, but vain to the point of absurdity. Who really doubts that our war on terrorism is seeding new generations of hatred and vengeance? And are we really on for an eternal war with the children of this battle today? It's been fascinating these last 3 weeks in Singapore just to sit there and to try to absorb a little bit of the Southeast Asian perspective. In the Singaporean view, it's a Chinese world. Fewer than 4 million smart, busy Singaporeans looking at 1,200 million smart, busy Chinese. The Chinese have got their World Trade Act together and their factories humming, and they're fully capable of outproducing the high-tech Asian tigers in volume and at much lower unit costs. 4 million looking at 1,200 million, it's a prospect to concentrate the minds, but it scarcely enters into our American consciousness or even our conversation. Singaporeans, incidentally, are totally fixed on this conversation about remaking Singapore. And it's a kind of long story, and I won't get into the whole thing, but I kept wondering, why are they remaking Singapore? And why isn't Paris remaking Paris, or Texas remaking Texas, or Boston, for that matter, remaking Boston? Does Philadelphia have any more to lose in this new global economy than Singapore, for example? And what is it about these people, certain kind of paranoia, they were born in crisis, they see themselves eternally in crisis, but what is it about them that generates this terrific introspection and rededication for newness, for new world? I'm not here to say it's entirely a good thing either, but it's very, very interesting. They're talking all the time about remaking ourselves for a new world, and I wish, you know, I wish we were all a little bit deeper into that kind of conversation. Fourth general point I want to leave you with, the internet possibilities in serving this project, this culture that's trying to happen, are infinite. We heard the hideous dreams about the internet in Africa, which is just getting wired. Africa's hope is to leapfrog the Industrial Revolution into the new web zone that doesn't know origin or color or race. That's a place where a Ghanaian student or researcher is instantly on the same page with a German, where a musician or a pineapple farmer can market his wares directly to the world, so unlike those British colonial railroads that pointed one way from the cocoa fields or the gold mines to the harbor. You can get anywhere from the internet, and you can be anybody. Funny thing was, we heard least about the internet in Singapore, which is wired to the nines, but hasn't figured out at the government level what the implications for freedom are going to be. So they don't want you to talk about it. The websites of the political opposition were shut down before the last election, just in case. OB markers are up all around the deeper internet discussion, although that ban obviously cannot last forever. On the internet end of our own local global radio conversation, we're not out of the technical difficulties phase that television finally got through. There are terrific technical minds in this room who can testify how chancy it was to receive our webcasts from Singapore, although there were breakthrough moments, and we've saved it all for the archives anyway. But the technical obstacles are nothing like as big as the imaginative openings. In media land, we find ourselves at a new intersection of local broadcasting and global electronics. We have yet to find out what sort of environment this might become, what sort of ecology this crossroads, these crossed wires can produce. But I want to nudge the answer in the direction of civility, openness, and substance. I think of us as building a new coral reef of conversation in a new sort of ocean, and who knows quite what's going to happen there. Which brings me to the final point that has come to be slowly in this fallow year since we lost the old connection. The gift we found in that wonderful space was not so much for radio as it was for community making, for sustaining a network, well represented in this room tonight, a network of strong-spirited folk, talkers and listeners, who love the process of building this rather mysterious but precious house of conversational cards. Out of the blue yesterday came an email from a regular old caller, Zirmine, who has moved in the past year or so from MIT to Pakistan and now to Houston, but she just wanted to remind me how those radio mornings had colored her whole Boston experience, she said, in an unforgettable way. The technology of radio and of the internet is crucial, in a sense, for the culture that's trying to happen, but the essence of it, nonetheless, is the many-layered magic, the grit, the variety, the dynamic range, the accent, and the authenticity of free voices. Vox humana, as the master studs Turkle puts it. So, in conclusion, count me in on all we can do to liberate and extend all the power for good and all the pleasures of that fabulous instrument. Thank you. Thank you. I'd be happy to take questions, comments, brickbats, arguments. This is the moment when we go to callers, 1-800. Please.